I feel a little very humble here. I think most of you know more about the details of Wittgenstein than I do. But perhaps I can take some consolation of the fact, or at least I think it's a fact that Wittgenstein was dyslexic and as a consequence thought very much more holistically than so-called normal people. So what I'll be trying to do is not so much to give detailed interpretation of this or that passage in Wittgenstein, although I consider it extremely important, but to try to give some make some rather general remarks on some parts of his philosophy. And perhaps I can explain what I mean by that by saying that there are certain principles that I think should guide us in reading Wittgenstein and interpreting Wittgenstein. And I think probably the most important ones are that much of his philosophy only becomes understandable, makes sense, or you can only see its wits, as Wittgenstein would have said, in terms of his philosophy, in terms of his development. So what I'll be trying to do is to sketch one line of development of his ideas make some suggestions as to how this explains the specific things he has said or wrote. There are other changes, and perhaps one of them should be taken as a, I should briefly mention that as a background of my the rest of my story. I'm not going to go into the early Wittgenstein. My reading of the early Wittgenstein, the philosophy of the Tractatus, is as a variant of the development of some ideas in Russell and Russell's theory of acquaintance. But I will not go into that. Rather, I begin from what happened to when Wittgenstein began to move away from that position. One of the first changes was that he became to believe that the language world relations are not constituted by simple name object relations, but are required or are maintained or whatever you want to say by certain human activities. And these human activities take place in time, so whatever we talk about in a language, the objects that we talk about the language must be temporarily permanent and permanent in physical space, physical time, because that's where our lives are, our activities take place. But he had that led him to a problem about since his ontology was still and his picture of language was still phenomenological in the original specific way, he would have to find phenomenological objects that are permanent in time. But what are they? Not physical objects. They are not necessarily permanent, nor things like after images, maybe colors, Wittgenstein says to himself, what are colors objects? Well, colors are in color space, like physical objects in physical space. What is a color, especially a space? He goes on. And then, if I remember correctly, on the 11th of October 1929, Wittgenstein reaches the point, he realizes that he's on the wrong track. He writes recitedly, immediate perception, everything is a state of flux. It is like a river. And then he draws a little picture of a river. And the next thing he says, next philosophical thing he says, that if I want to say, roughly, this is not a literal quote, he says, if I want to say anything more here, I will bump against the limits of language. And the next philosophical entry in his diaries is the first time he asserts the primacy of physicalistic, everyday physicalistic languages over phenomenological languages. You can see it's very dramatic. You can see, almost literally see him changing his mind. Well, anyway, but this is only background for my real, well, main story. The important thing here is to be precise about what changed in Wittgenstein. What he changed his mind was not so much the ontology. He was not really the ontology he was assuming, but the way our language works in relation to that ontology. Sometimes I say in teaching Wittgenstein that the most important, perhaps the most important thing he's ever he said about this area. He only said and didn't write down, because this is in the record of his lectures. At one point he is reported as saying, "The world we live in is the world of sense data, but the world we talk about in language is the world of physical objects." Now this requires an explanation, because sense data were not anything subjective. You could have, say, more self-explanatory statement would have been that the world we live in is the world of phenomenological objects. But the language, but the world, etc., etc. And by phenomenological objects, Wittgenstein, of course, did not mean any more than Husserl did anything subjective or anything. It was simply the objective objects, so to speak, of our experiences. But the phenomenological object was not intended to be in contrary to this. Is not necessarily something different from physical objects in our sort of common sense understanding, but they have to be the objects of our immediate experience. Anyway, so it was not the phenomenological ontology that Wittgenstein gave up, but it was the idea that we can refer to those objects directly without the mediation of some activities, because and also the idea was that indirectly we can refer only in the first place we can only refer to physical objects, not in the sense of objects of physics, but everyday physical objects. This is only a background, but it's a very important part of the background of the centerpiece of my story, which is this: if now the language world, all important language world relations, are no longer picture relations based on name object relations if they require human activities, rule governed human activities, for so to speak, for the existence and maintenance, then the interesting questions, the crucial questions, will become about those, the rules of these activities and about the rules in general. What does it? What the question, the notion of rule, becomes crucial, crucial for Wittgenstein, so that his later interest in rules is not a separate, not a work on a subject separate from the rest of philosophy. It's the understanding rules was the absolutely necessary condition for him to understand, well, for us to understand his philosophy, and for it was a center, was a cell at the center of his own thinking. Now, what was the problem? Another, if I may make a inject a general comment here, one difficulty we all have in reading Wittgenstein is, to put it psychological terms, is impatience. You may remember from the Fania Pascal's story about Wittgenstein's confession, that the punchline there, in some sense, was that was to wonder what an extraordinary thing Wittgenstein was. He was so how impatient he was, and of course this shows up in these philosophical writings and philosophical thought. If I may put it in sort of perhaps slightly overstated terms, Wittgenstein was so anxious often to explain his new ideas and to clarify them that he forgot or neglected to tell what his problems were. Well, this didn't make much difference in the pre-World War I days. I think Wittgenstein's problems were the same as those of Russell and perhaps others in Cambridge, maybe perhaps even Johnson. And it didn't matter crucially, I claim, in the early 30s either, in relation to Vienna Circle, in spite of the popular view of the country, the Vienna Circle people had very much the same problems, and sometimes very closely related answers, as Wittgenstein had. But this came very crucial when Wittgenstein began to have his own students. They had, so to speak, had not grown up philosophically with Wittgenstein. They didn't know Wittgenstein's background, it seems to me that they were not particularly focused on Wittgenstein's problems, even though he admired him and appreciated perhaps his answers. And I think that as a consequence, they are not necessarily at all the best interpreters of Wittgenstein. And by early students, I mean people like Malcolm, and others, even Anscombe and Geats, to some extent belong to this. Belong to this category. So, but there are some exceptions, and fortunately, the rule following problem or rule problem is one of them. And there, Wittgenstein explains what his problem is. This is in precisely where you would expect to find it. This is in the Blue Book, early in the Blue Book, and there, Wittgenstein does ask, in so many words, okay, I forgot something. Anyway, he asks in so many words, what does it mean to follow a rule? And he says his answer is roughly, well, not so much roughly, but in outline, is this: you can mean two different things with it. You can simply mean that to follow a rule is simply to act in accordance with it, whatever that means. But this, Wittgenstein says, is not what we mean by really following the rule. The only thing you can ask, if this is what we mean, is the scientific factual question: how come you came to behave in this way? The questions you ask are simply scientific questions of how were you trained to do this. No, Wittgenstein says no. What should be meant by following a rule? In order to say that we follow a rule, the rule itself should play a role in the action of following it. And Wittgenstein's an example might be, this is not Wittgenstein's example, but this would be kind of obvious thing. If I'm following a rule expressed by algebraic formula in calculation, what do I do in sort of schematic thinking? I replace algebraic symbols by numerals, and then I calculate with this. These symbols. So the algebraic formula actually was a part of the operation. Wittgenstein's own example is extremely intriguing and also has other ramifications. That is his famous thought experiment of people who use color words in a way different, perhaps not. Anyway, that's a different problem. In a peculiar way, they use color words only by means of a color chart. They can't do anything else. If I ask what's the color of this book, such a member of imaginary tribe would take his color chart and compare the book with the samples on the color chart, and locate the one that whose color matches most closely the color of this book, and then he reads the word that's written under the sample and says, well, it is blue, and here of course the color chart plays integral part in the use of the color vocabulary. Wittgenstein doesn't say that this is how we use, the humans use color words. However, it would be actually rather interesting to compare this what the neuroscientists say about colors. For instance, there is a condition, a rare but very interesting condition, called color agnosia, and a person suffering such a condition has, by all criteria, normal color vision. This person can, for instance, make all the color distinctions that the rest of us do, but cannot talk about colors. If I ask this person, what is this color of this book? Blank. Point to something red. Blank. And of course, the quickest way of describing the condition of this such a person is to say that he's like a member of the Wittgensteinian tribe who's lost his color chart. He sees everything correctly but can't make use of it, so to speak, all of these. Anyway, so Wittgenstein says, what Wittgenstein says is that Wittgenstein's point is, that in order, to speak of genuine rule following, the rule itself must play part in the actions of actions in following the rule. And now, now his earlier change into the physicalistic language comes in. I'm not sure that I want to go into the details, but as a consequence of that, a consequence of his rejection of phenomenological languages, he essentially says, and in this case, and all these cases, we can in principle think of the rule as being expressed by some external object of for formula on a paper or the color chart or anything. So now the question is, how can this formulation of the rule play a part in our rule following? But how can it? The rule is there, the expression of the rule is there. It's a one physical object in principle outside there. How can it guide my thinking? As what Wittgenstein once says, a rule cannot operate at a distance. Well, how can it? And now my thesis here is, and this I've elaborated about this earlier, this is his rule problem. Wittgenstein's problem with rules is not epistemological problem or rule following. It's not question whether I know the rule that I have to follow, I'm supposed to follow, or whether I know that I'm using a rule correctly. It's how can a rule guide me there? And I think this should be fairly obvious, should be obvious on sort of general grounds. Wittgenstein says that he is not trying to change our how we ordinarily use the language. And of course, in ordinary usage, we do speak of knowing a rule. When I'm teaching this in a class, I do kind of Wittgensteinian experiment and write a sequence of numbers on a chalkboard and say, what's the rule here? And of course, everybody, there's absolutely general agreement, although it's a relatively short segment of numbers, everybody, it makes sense, perfect sense to ask, what is the rule that's here? One devious question I'm asking, I'm writing the decimal expansion of pi there, and the students are looking for some simple formula for succession. Of course, there is none, no easy one. But once they see it as an expansion of pi, well, everybody knows then, realizes what the rule is. So in our ordinary life, we talk about knowing a rule, and so on and so forth. So the epistemic problem cannot be on these grounds be the problem. It's rather, how can this dead object there, a formula on the paper, how can it influence, how can it determine what I'm doing? And of course, the Wittgensteinian criterion, now I refer back to the October 29 change, of course, since the world we live in is the world of phenomenological objects, if there is a difference, it will have to show show itself phenomenologically. In other words, I have to have an experience of rule following, or experience of correct rule following, or whatever there is. Much so, of course, in the rule discussion in the investigations is precisely to argue that we do not have experience. The experiences of this kind, or if we have, they are not what it means to follow a rule. Now Wittgenstein's problem is not epistemological; it doesn't have anything to do with any kind of intentionality. It's the same problem as the question. It's the same problem as the question: how does the blueprint of a machine guide the motions of the machine? And in fact, Wittgenstein is using quite frequently using machine analogies to illustrate his problems, and in particular, he's using machine analogies to discuss the problem of rule determination. There's an interesting unpublished study by a young Austrian Wittgenstein scholar dealing with the Wittgenstein's machine analogies. He's actually trying to use the machine analogies to understand the human rule following or acting against according to a rule, and this has nothing to do with intentionality. If I'm using little detail there that I think is actually really telling, a later thinker might ask. Does a computer really think? No, this is not Wittgenstein is asking. He's asking, does a computer compute? Is this really an instantiation of acting in accordance with a rule in a genuine sense? So this is his problem, and he works on this and agonizes about it. What happens? There would be very interesting talks for somebody which I haven't had an occasion to do, of really going to the detailed remarks of Wittgenstein from this period. What happens? Wittgenstein fails. He cannot find an explanation of how the rule out there determines our actions. This is one aspect. By the way, I might have illustrated this. Special case of this rule following problem is the ideological logical necessity, which is an important problem for Wittgenstein. At first sight, it looks as if Wittgenstein is simply misunderstanding, as many people misunderstand the nature of so-called rules of inference in logic. If you look at them, they are sort of The so-called rules of inference in formal logic are not rules. They don't tell us what to do. They are not prescriptive rules at all. They are not neither descriptive rules. They don't tell what people do. They are merely permissive. The usual rules of logic, inference rules, are merely permissive, and therefore they are not really. There's nothing about. They are completely irrelevant to the question of logical necessity. I don't know whether Wittgenstein was really clear about this, but that doesn't matter, because the problem of logical necessity the other aspects are the important for Wittgenstein. Again, he has a problem of understanding what is going on here. At one point, he says that he can understand. He can understand very well geometrical necessity, but he cannot understand what logical necessity is. And discussing the Gödel's theorem, he says he can understand how a geometrical theorem as a sequence of symbols there applies to itself, namely the sequence of symbols on the paper. But he cannot understand how an arithmetical or logical statement can apply to itself. So that's Wittgenstein's problem of logical necessity is a case of his worries about rules and rules and acting accordance with the rule in general. And of course, here I'm sure you remember. Perhaps I should have here quotations from the rule discussion to illustrate this. But I think you can remember many of them yourself. And also what is important to realize here is the generality of this problem, because the early discussions on rule following or rule guidance were in this published as a part of the Remarks on the Foundations of Mathematics. However, the most important, what I consider the most important of these discussions, was originally not a part of a manuscript on mathematics, but it was in some of the early versions of investigations. It played the same role there as the rule. It was in the same place, so to speak, as the rule following discussion of the published investigations. So this is completely general and is only illustrated by Wittgenstein's remarks on mathematics rules in mathematics. But Wittgenstein struggled with this problem, and in the sort of trivial sense of the word, failed. Enzo de Pellegrin, compiled these references to machines and machine uses of machine analogy, and they stop at a certain point in Wittgenstein's notebooks. I haven't verified this, but this seems to be the case. So what does this mean? I think it meant an extremely important change in Wittgenstein's position. And the main point I want to make here is that this change of his position is what really is the background of the investigations, at least the part one. For what does it, what Wittgenstein could do? In briefest possible terms, he went back to the dichotomy that he started from in the Blue Book. The contrast was between simply acting in accordance with rules, as distinguished from the rule playing a role in the actual rule following. Now the second one, second idea didn't work out, so Wittgenstein was forced to back to the first idea that all we can say about rule following is acting in accordance with the rule. And the main question then becomes not so much the particular rules, but how come a speaker of the language was brought to the state in which he or she does this. And so the emphasis now is the emphasis shifts from the rules to the entire rule-following activity, which really means the shift of emphasis from particular rules to the complexes of activities that Wittgenstein called language games. So in systematic terms, this means that entire language games became primary in his thinking as in comparison with the rules of the activity. And this is of course reflected by Wittgenstein's general comments on his basic concepts in the middle period, when the rules were the most important thing. There's a passage, once again I don't remember quite the verbal formulation, but basically Wittgenstein says, don't try to look behind the rules, there isn't anything there. But now the emphasis shifts, now the primacy is with the language games, and therefore you have statements like the something you all remember, Wittgenstein says that our investigations must sometimes ultimately reach the point where the only thing I can say, this language game is being played. That's the ultimate stopping point of an inquiry. So I think this then reflects on what he writes about rules in the investigations, when he says that rules are followed automatically. It doesn't mean, of course, in the obvious sense of in the trivial everyday sense of that people actually behave like trained automata. He's talking about logical priorities. The ultimate. You don't explain rules. You don't explain a language game by specifying its rules. You understand the rules by coming to know how the entire language game is being played. And my sort of general point here is precisely this. This is the background, so to speak, the immediate background of much of the philosophical investigations. It's his response to the situation in which he ended up by his inquiry into the operation of rules. And I think this may in this way. Much of the many other things in the philosophical investigations become understandable. For instance, the primary language games don't operate by criteria; they are taught. If you and you don't ask for the rules. And in particular, one major feature of the philosophical investigations that I think becomes understandable from the point of these developments is that this may be one of the most important features of the investigations anyway, although it's perhaps not very conspicuous. Of course, so that the typical or primary language games, according to this position that Wittgenstein ended up with, is that we are trained. To behave in the same in a certain way in a language game, and the only thing we can but the training is by literally training and as distinguished from teaching all the rules, and Wittgenstein thinks this is the so the primary way in which language operates, but of course this cannot be the whole story, because not all of our language operates in this way. So Wittgenstein has to make a distinction, and this is reflected, for instance, in his example about I think I may have the quote here, but it doesn't really matter. When he says that he does speak of two ways of using words. His example is something like this: I'm out there in the countryside, and my friend points to an animal out there and says, "What is it?" And I sort of consider it and say, "Oh." Consider and see what it looks like, and then say it's a rabbit. In contrast to a situation in which all of a sudden an animal jumps out of the bushes and I say a rabbit. In the second case, I suppose the point is that I don't use any criterion. I don't see how long its ears or anything. I react to this animal in linguistically correct way. So Wittgenstein has to distinguish, and there are many others, different kinds of language games. So each other language games become primary with respect to the rules. But basically, only in the basic language games that connect language with reality, they operate with learned or trained responses to different kinds of situations, So there's a distinction between, or a general distinction in Wittgenstein, between what I have tried to call primary language games and secondary language games. One problem here is that these terms are not Wittgenstein's, but in a moment I'll try to explain why it's correct to use them anyway. The reason why Wittgenstein doesn't make this distinction is that he dislikes all the sharp distinctions in the use of language anyway. Now, but another thing that follows is that in these primary language games, that, so to speak, in some sense, form the rock bottom of language, since they operate with this. Simply the learned responses. We cannot use because of the immediacy. We cannot use epistemic concepts in them. because their epistemic concepts require precisely the kind of reflection that that is characteristic of secondary language games. In other words, in a primary language game, it's inappropriate to speak of doubt or certainty or even error. These are out of place. They don't belong to that these primary language games. One of the famous illustrations of Wittgenstein's of this point is when he imagines that a doctor asking a nurse, "Is the patient in pain?" And the nurse says, "He's moaning." Period. End of story. It doesn't make sense in the primary language game with pain expressions to ask, "Are you sure he's in pain?" You go and help him. This is the kind of language game into which the pain expressions belong. Of course, in other cases, one language game literally presupposes another. Those are actually sort of perhaps easier to master, understand conceptually. For instance, the language game of lying makes only sense on the basis of language game of truth telling. It's a parasitic on the language game of truth telling. If everybody always lied, lying would never be successful. So lying would not serve any purpose any longer. So there are other differences between secondary and primary and secondary languages. But you can see also perhaps even in the more clearly the argument that the structure of the investigations. First, Wittgenstein explains the notion of language game and this his overall picture of language and its relation to reality. Then he makes some general philosophical comments. I forget the precise paragraphs, but beginning was somewhere around, what is it, 143, he discusses the rules for the reasons that are implicit in what I've already said, and then he discusses what looks like a specific application of his ideas, namely the ways we speak of our internal experiences, for instance, of pain, the so-called private language discussion. That's really an explanation of what primary language games are like, an example. And in fact, Wittgenstein indicates, although perhaps he should have emphasized it more, that this discussion is much more general than it might first look like. He does say things like that the color words operate in the same way as the expressions of pain, which at first sight is quite striking, but is, as far as I can see, simply an example of part of this is sort of explanation by partly, largely by example, explanation is what the nature of the whole private language discussion is really part of the explanation of primary language games. One major difference is, of course, is that unlike the primary language games, in secondary language games we can have epistemic concepts. Their secondary language games can operate by criteria. However, I think that Wittgenstein's one of the one of the Wittgenstein's ideas, although this is perhaps not less clear than some of the others, is that the that when we use epistemic notions in different secondary language games, the criteria may be different in different secondary language games. So the use of words like know and doubt are relevant, are relative to a particular kind of secondary language game that we have. There are further consequences, very important consequences for the Wittgenstein's general ideas that follow here. One major one, and this would really perhaps require a finer analysis that I can give it to here, is that this change makes a difference to the very difficult question as to whether the kind of inexpressibility of semantical relations or world language relations that Wittgenstein maintains in the Tractatus, whether he still believes it in his later philosophy. This is a very tricky point, but this change that I explained is affected by it, because if language games can be explained by the rules, and of course the language games are the primary links between language and reality, they are the essentially Wittgensteinian semantics. If they can be defined by their rules, then we can speak of the language-world relations. The inexpressibility cannot be as strict as it is in the Tractatus. But if the language games are primary and cannot be analyzed in terms of the rules, then there will be an inexpressibility in language. The only way, because the only way of understanding a language game is to learn to play it. So the inexpressibility is restored, so to speak. Now, this is all. You may have heard some or read some of these things before, but what I would like to do, but I really don't have time, but I would at least post a problem to you. Is this the whole story? Is the investigations interpreted perhaps in the way I do or some other way? Is it the kind of the philosophy of Wittgenstein's? And here, as you all know, there have been controversies. Some recent scholars have found what they call the third Wittgenstein. And there's even the editorial textual question of the relation of the part two of the philosophical investigations to the part one. And there are all sorts of intricate problems here. Which are not very easy to, not very easy to solve. You may be aware of the difficulty of telling how Wittgenstein himself conceived of the relation of so-called part one to the part one, part two to the part one. I don't have to explain here the details of those. So the question is, what else can we say here? I think I don't have the detailed analysis because this is very much a work in progress. But I can state one vision on these relations. I think Wittgenstein, I don't think he's changed his view of the primary language games. But he realized that even the primary language games are more, there's a more structure there than he first realized. And he was also became keenly aware of the multitude of problems concerning secondary language games. And I think what happened was that even though Wittgenstein began to work on these problems only after he already wrote a preface to the first part of it, that became the preface to the entire work, these are perhaps to some extent new concerns, but they grow out the problematic of the philosophical investigations. But they led to new problems. But what Wittgenstein managed to say, all those problems is still a continuation of what he was doing in the philosophical investigations. For instance, he came to realize that even these sort of unedited reactions that he perhaps seemed to be working with in the investigations are not so, that they do have a structure, that there is something to be said and something to be understood in them. Because suppose there's an animal that jumps up. And I said, "Oh, rabbit! But what if I see it incorrectly? If it really is a duck and not a rabbit?" My use of language is a reaction to the concrete situation, and it's taught in it's acquired in the same way as Wittgenstein thinks in the investigations. But there's a difference in those two. And even in primary reactions, primary language games, there is a difference. There is a difference in seeing perhaps even one and the same object in different ways. There is, in other words, the seeing as problem, and this is no longer primary and secondary language games. This is something problem about the primary language games and what happens in them, and also the seeing as has a, what shall I say, has a this is not word, the word is not Wittgenstein's, and I'm not sure whether it's the happiest one. There's a cognitive element. There's an intellectual difference between there's a difference between ducks and rabbits, and this is perhaps the most intriguing aspect of this. That distinction is also a difference in experience. The difference is built in the experience itself. So it's a phenomenological difference. And because this the most famous case is the Necker cube. I see it in two different ways. And this is certainly, if there's anything, is a phenomenological, it's a phenomenological difference. In fact, in a Tractatus, Wittgenstein had used the Necker cube essentially to argue that what we see are phenomenological objects. The objects of our visual perception are phenomenological objects. This example comes back to haunt him. These primary language games can't be, or so it seems, completely physicalistic any longer. So the very phenomenological, physical contrast becomes a problem. I don't know what Wittgenstein ended up saying this, and as I said, I'm still trying to understand that myself, but what happened was that, historically, is that Wittgenstein continued this thinking beyond the ideas that I said were from the sort of official view of in the Tractatus, first part of the Tractatus, and he was pushed to new problems, but I don't see that there's any sharp break or that the that there is a really sort of new synthesis in his very latest writings. I just can't find it, and in that sense, I don't think there's a third Wittgenstein, if I may make a conjecture. I don't think there's a separate position, but there's a continuation of the same themes, perhaps beyond the confines of the investigations. And I think I could even argue for this one on sort of more textual and technical ways, because as I've argued elsewhere, in those writings that he intended for publication, and of course the second part certainly was, is that Wittgenstein usually states in the first 5-10 pages, whatever, depends, his main view, and then goes on to discuss that. So usually in the manuscripts, typescripts he prepared or hoped to become publishable, he begins by explaining his basic ideas. Now in the second part of the Philosophical Investigations, there's no new beginning. The first questions he asks there are precisely questions concerning the relation of primary and secondary language games. Third Wittgenstein, no. Continuity, yes. Well, what else can I say? Well, I think that I should perhaps stop here. I can fill in the discussion if needed. The answer perhaps the best answer I can give to the old question, how many Wittgensteins were there? Maybe 2 plus epsilon, or something like that. Thank you.